This is episode 12 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
2% doesn't sound like much. But 2% of the entire planet, of every person on it, that's more than the world's 10 largest cities combined. It's 140 million people. And like that, they were gone.
All the way from Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the show The Leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's talk with Mimi Leader. Suddenly I'm hidden. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name is Blake. And I'm so freaking excited about this interview. I couldn't wait, first, to tell everybody about it. Number two, to record it. And number three, to now give it to you, our wonderful listeners.
We know that so many of you have been listening to our podcast throughout the season, and this is a very special treat. Some of you may be sitting here saying, who is Mimi Leader? She was the director of three of these episodes, including the finale, which we just saw.
And she's directed a whole bunch of other things, too, and we'll get into that later on in the interview. But this lady is like...
She's awesome.
She's important. Like, she is like... She's like legit.
One of my favorite things that we asked her was, you know, like, how did you get chosen for this? You know, thinking it was some crazy application process and she had to go in. And remember Kath Lingenfelter? She said she got the job because she cried in front of Damon. Mimi was like, I got it. I did.
Well, don't ruin the interview. Just
no, it just shows you how badass she is.
Yeah, she just walked in.
And not to say that Kath isn't, because I freaking love Kath. But Mimi is a somebody. We're going to tell you a bit more about what she's done, but just take a moment to look on her IMDb page. I mean, this woman knows her stuff.
It's like miles long, her IMDb page.
She is one smart cookie, and she loves the art of directing.
Yes, she does. She gets really into it, and she describes everything that she did, and actually, she was great. Right before we started recording, she was saying how she's a much better director than she is an interviewee. And I was like, oh, no, come on. You're going to be great. It's going to be awesome.
She was great. You know, when I try to think about how to describe to people what the director does, I always think back to how we originally heard stories. Mm-hmm. It was orally. You know, like, there were storytellers. There are authors. And then there's people who tell you the story. And the directors are the ones that take those stories from the pages and they tell it to you, and they make you feel it. Mm-hmm. And that's what Mimi does. She's a fine, fine storyteller.
And the job that she did on that finale, I mean, it just speaks for itself. We can't sit here and shower any more praise on her. We really can't. Nobody else can. The work speaks for itself.
So enough said. Let's start our interview. Joining us now is Mimi Leader, director of feature films such as The Peacemaker, Deep Impact, and Pay It Forward. She's also helmed numerous episodes of television series, including The West Wing, ER, Luck, Nashville, Smash, Almost Human, and Shameless. But she is exceptionally important to us because she directed three episodes of The Leftovers, including that unbelievable finale, The Prodigal Son Returns. Thank you so much for joining us, Mimi.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here.
So it sounds like you could have your pick in anything you want as a director. How did you get the job with The Leftovers?
Well, Damon Lindelof approached me and asked me to direct Gladys. And I was very intrigued with the world that Tom Perata and he had created and came aboard. And then I read the script, and it was like, oh, my God, how am I going to direct the stoning? How am I going to do this? And it was extremely challenging and very, very painful to do, not just physically for the actress, who I did not hurt, but was really quite challenging on many levels, because Gladys had become a beloved character, and still is, to all of us. And there she was. There I was, dragging her through the woods. And it was a very challenging scene to do, where she has a vow of silence, and where she stones are being thrown at her, and where she cries out that last part of her, that human part of her that wanted to, of course, live. So it was a fascinating challenge to shoot, to not hurt her, mm-hmm. To do. And I had to do it very, relatively quickly. I decided to do it very simply, photographically. I decided to, drag her through the woods, very handheld, very messy, very painful. I wanted it to feel painful. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to tie her up and not move the camera so much. Just shoot her from the front, from the guys who were throwing the stones point of view, and, past her and profile. And it was very hard to do, because we even made, we made rocks out of beanbags.
I was wondering if it was foam or a beanbag type of thing, so I'm glad to know what it is.
Yeah, we had foam, we had beanbags. None of it really worked, because the beanbags actually hurt.
Oh.
The foam was too light. And so a lot of the stones that you see are CGI. They're VFX. I put them in after.
Good.
And, I would... It's kind of hard to talk about this, because it kind of demystifies how it feels. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is kind of a sequence that maybe I shouldn't be talking about.
No, it was something, it was so incredibly done. Really, I couldn't watch it. We often repeat watch the show, and I couldn't watch that scene for a while, because it really bothered me. We had this ongoing joke, because we didn't know Gladys's name until that episode. We called her Mom Hair. That's what we would call her on the podcast. We just called her Mom Hair. And, when you see her in the episode beforehand, and she's walking up and trying to take the pictures from the people's houses, and we were like, what's Mom Hair up to? And this episode just humanized her, as you said, so much. And for someone who we didn't really care about too much, that we would just joke about, and we cared about her so much that I couldn't even watch the stoning again.
It's painful. I can barely watch it.
Yeah, and you directed it, so that...
I know. I was hard directing it, because I loved her so much. I actually directed her in an ER many years ago, and, that was pretty... That was quite fascinating to see, meet her again and work with her. And, you find out about her, like you said, in that episode. You find out that her son was killed, in Kuwait, I think. And you find out that, that Patty brought her to that restaurant. And you found out how strong she was and how dedicated she was. And you are not sure if she is martyring herself. Mm-hmm. Some people, I think, got it, with the silent looks in the beginning of the show, between Patty and Gladys. You're going, what the hell is that? This silent thing going on between them that they're both getting. What are we missing? What are we supposed to get out of this? So some people got it, and some obviously, don't get it until episode 8. When Kevin asks Patty, what about Gladys? And Patty says she was okay with it. So then people say, oh, but it's one of the things the GR wanted and needed to do, to be living reminders of the past, and to make people feel and think. And remember.
So in addition to Gladys, you also directed Solace for Tired Feet. So between the three episodes that you directed, which was actually you directed the most episodes out of anybody, even more than Peter Berg, so congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. After I directed Gladys, they asked me to come on as a executive producer, director, and I did.
So with that in mind, how closely did you work with Damon Lindelof and Tom Perata to realize their vision? Was this a constant back and forth? Did you have freedom to do what you wanted? What did you do with those guys to realize their vision?
Damon and I would meet and, tone the shows, talk about what he intended, and to make sure that I understood, what his intention as the writer was. And so we spoke very, very in depth about scenes and what they meant, and this is something you do always, a director, an executive producer, writer, you talk about what the scenes are, what they mean, even if they're pretty self-explanatory. It's worth discussing. Stuff comes out of it, for example, in episode 10, when Laurie leaves after the aftermath, she has that look to Kevin and she can't look at them. She can't stay with them. She goes and she walks into Memorial Park. Well, that was written as a scene where she's walking by the road and Tom pulls up, So out of, while I was scouting, I found, I went to Memorial Park where Peter had shot the riot. And I said, why does she come here and look at that statue and then just wander off towards, there was a jetty. I said, there's this jetty and she could be staring at the water. And, so you talk about the moments and how we can make them perhaps better visually. And so that, for example, came out of a tone meeting or came out of a discussion Damon and I had. So, yes, I work very closely with Damon. And it was really interesting when I was shooting. I know I'm talking about the finale, but when, Tom Perata came by a couple of times when I was shooting. And to answer your question, I had complete freedom to design my show, visually and did. And it was just so, fascinating. When I was shooting the end of the show, of the finale, where she finds the baby, where Nora finds the baby, he came to watch that scene. And it was, because it's in the book. And I kept saying, is this what you imagined? Is this what you were thinking? And, he just was thrilled. And the smile on his face at his book and his vision coming to life was quite beautiful to behold. It was quite lovely.
Speaking about the finale, let's talk about it a bit. This episode seemed to have two different tones. The first beginning with Kevin and his dilemma with Patty and Matt, and then the rioting with the guilty remnant. So what were some of the challenges you faced to make it flow properly?
The tone of the beginning of the episode is quite different than where it goes. And, episode 8 and 10 could have been a two-parter, right? But for the brilliance of Damon to put that flashback episode right in the middle, really actually put context into the show, gave the audience context for the characters that I think really enhanced your feelings moving into episode 10. So we start on the Shard of Glass, and I did this corkscrew shot because I wanted to sort of, wind out of like where episode 8 left off with Patty's death and him sitting there, Kevin sitting there in a reflection of a pool of blood. And I just felt, wow, this is just cool. And I've got to say that, Damon is the mad genius who chose the Nina Simone song and put it in the cut. And he also found the Metallica cue, and you know, two of my most favorite cues ever, because I just kind of sit there and weep when I hear Nina Simone sing, and it's such a sad song. Anyway, to go back to whatever question I was answering, yeah, so Kevin had to, he needed help, so he calls, makes a phone call, we don't know who he's calling, Matt shows up. You know, Matt shows up and helps his friend, and helps him, you know, by helping to bury her, the woman who stole his church. He wanted to save them, you know, Matt wanted to save these people. Anyway, he helps Kevin bury her. And he also helps them spiritually, I believe, in giving him the passage from Job to read, and helps him to move forward, I think. And Justin, wow, he did such an incredibly beautiful job reading the passage from the Bible. It was heartbreaking. We were all holding our breaths. It was quite beautiful that he went very deep, and we were all like in rather despair because we were burying Patty, and we loved her so much as a character. And so that was a very interesting and difficult scene to shoot, but breathtaking, because Ann Dowd playing dead is as mesmerizing as she can do no wrong, this woman. This woman is the most extraordinary actress.
She's just good at everything.
Everything. And she's actually a beautiful, kind-hearted woman. You know, she's just a great person, too. So it was hard killing her, and or her killing herself. It was hard. It was hard.
Can you talk about the riot scene, for example? Like when the
sure.
with the GR compound, it was massive.
Sure. But,
how did that all come together?
Yeah, but I wanted to get, I just wanted to finish this up. So Kevin goes through a journey of burying Patty and then confessing to Matt, you know, what he understood, and confessing that he wanted to leave his family. And, you know, and then he runs into, it was just one scene after another, and then he runs into, coincidentally, Holy Wayne, who had a huge effect on his son's life. And then we're in this sort of dream. We're going back to Mapleton. Go back to Mapleton in this sort of dream state. You think the worst is over. And then we get into Mapleton, and Mapleton isn't anything like we left it. It's, well, I mean, it's the calm before the storm, before we left it. Like the GR was up to something. What were they up to? And we get a first glimpse when we see the mother from the pilot running across the street with a gun, shooting at these people, at these GR who are carrying a loved one. And we find Meg tied to a tree, tied to a pole. And we, you know, she writes, we made them remember. You know, Kevin says, what did you do? What did you do? And she says, we made them remember. And aha, then we are getting into, then we drive into, you know, the madness. And it was a very challenging thing to direct the sequence of the gauntlet into the GR cul-de-sac, because I only had two days to do it. And I was working with VFX, special effects, several hundred extras. And, you know, our show isn't an action show. Our show is a show about, you know, character. Our show's a show about grief and despair. And our show is about family. And, you know, so we used our beautiful Max Richter music to take us through the gauntlet. And I tried to shoot it through Kevin's eyes, seeing all these loved ones being carried around. Where are they going? Into the GR. There's a bonfire. Bodies are being flown. It was, I tried to direct it through his emotion, through what he was feeling, what he was seeing. And when he gets into the gauntlet, he sees Charlie, the young man who's counting pennies in the Garveys at their best. He sees a, you know, this dummy of Charlie being thrown into the fire, being burned alive. I mean, he's not alive, but it was just a, we were just running and gunning, shooting. I planned it very carefully. I got what I could. The most important beats were, you know, obviously to find Laurie and being thrown down the stairs violently with the being, you know, having the shit kicked out of her and her saying her first words in 8 months, 8-9 months, which was Jill, because she had to save her daughter.
So what you caught in terms of Laurie screaming out Jill's name, I mean, it was absolutely stunning. And in effect, it was her first words that we had really seen. I mean, we did see, you know, her first words in episode 9, the Garveys at their best. But these were her real first words for us, you know, at least in a linear time frame.
That's correct.
So you have that, which was gorgeous, and then you have all the burning houses, which I imagine was probably VFX. Am I right in saying that?
Well, that was shot on a separate day, and some of it was real, and some of it was VFX. You know, the bonfire outside, we had a real bonfire, you know, a gas bonfire, and we added to it, and we added all the fire to the exterior. The interior, I did have some fire, some real fire, and then we, like I just said, we added to it, we added smoke. And because you can't use black smoke to work with, it's illegal and it's very bad and unhealthy. So we used white smoke and we made some of it black. And, you know, yeah, it was a combination. And, you know, we used a company called Dive in New York, out of New York, and amazing work, truly fascinating group of Pete guys. And, you know, just creating the aftermath as well. The aftermath, we put a lot of ash on the ground. You know, we ashed up all the actors. We had the remnants of wood, you know, because the townspeople not only tried to, you know, take some of the lives of the GR, but they, you know, threw their furniture into the bonfire. They wanted them out. And then we added, of course, the houses were there, and of course we took them out in that shot in the aftermath sequence.
So you have all these things going on, and it's just absolute chaos. Is this finally people snapping as the one of the Carver twins had suggested earlier in the season? Like, people just finally lost it, and what are going to be the repercussions of this massive fallout?
Well, yes. I mean, the GR's homes burning is definitely a reaction to the townspeople trying to take their town back and trying to, you know, take their lives back. And the GR made them feel. They made them remember, you know, what they're trying to desperately forget. Like Nora Durst, she very much was coming out of her pain, not completely, but she was making strides toward that in starting a relationship with Kevin. And she wakes up in the morning and there they are.
Which was stunning. Was it your choice to have no sound with her reaction?
Yeah. I mean, was it my choice? Yeah, I mean, I think I took it out in my cut. You know, I took the sound out in episode 7 as well, in the diner scene when Senior goes crazy. I just wanted to be in his head. And I mean, I think we played it both ways in the editing room. We had her scream in. I think Damon took it out. I can't remember. We very much love taking out sounds and playing the music and being in the heads of our characters. And I found it very effective to take her voice out, because I couldn't breathe when I was watching it. I would just like, she would be screaming and I'd be like, my mouth would be open and I would be like, oh, it just was so painful to watch. And, you know, it's one of those scenes where, God, you're going to shoot it and, you know, is it going to work? You know, how can I make this scene as simple and painful and powerful as possible? And, you know, and I had Carrie Coon, and she can do no wrong.
How do you do that? How do you direct a scene when you really are being wrapped up emotionally in what you're shooting?
Well, you have to be wrapped up. I mean, I'm very wrapped up emotionally in what I'm shooting. And we talked about the sequence before and how we were going to do it. And then she just did it, you know, and then she did it again and again and again. And it was extraordinary. And I had a couple cameras on her capturing it. You know, this was the, you know, pain that just burns through your soul. And, you know, after the aftermath, when we cut back to her, and we cut to the nuclear family sitting there, I asked her to hold her children's hands and caress them as if she was saying goodbye to them. And, you know, just kept it very simple. And it was just so freaky to see her sitting there with her children, with her loved ones. It was very crazy.
I agree. I had a lump in my throat, and gosh, you're right. That shot of her touching their hands, and then we got those close-ups of their faces, so you could really see that they're really fake. Like, what is she doing? But gosh, it was just creepy and sad. And you just, I almost don't have a word to describe it.
Well, the thing I felt when I was watching it was, does she have that sudden experience like, oh my God, my family's back. Like, this is real. And then all of a sudden she has that pain taken, like pain given back to her. Like, no, these are actually these fake dolls. This
right.
is not my family.
Yeah. I think the realization is that the pain will never, ever, ever go away. The loss of her loved ones. The loss of her children, the pain will always be there. And that's why she decides to leave and write Kevin that letter.
Speaking about Kevin, did he get his wish granted?
I think he did. I think there's potential there for the possibility of love, a purpose in his life. I think that, you know, his wish, you know, which is what, you know, is a new beginning. And I think you feel that. And that's where the show ends. Perhaps there's a new beginning, a rebirth. We'll see.
I felt that way because of the dog. That, you know, I was shaky. I didn't know what was going to be happening, but with that shot with the dog, and suddenly the dog is nice. And I'm not a dog person. And let me tell you, this show has kept me from being a dog person. I keep, after every episode, I go, look, Blake, that's why we're not getting a dog. But the dog was finally nice. And of course, that's Kevin. And Kevin's I don't know, I don't fully understand it, but I felt like Kevin was getting, as you said, a new beginning, possibly.
Yeah, well, you know, what are the dogs represented? Well, to many different people, they represent different things. But to some, perhaps, it represents humanity gone fucking crazy. You know, the dogs gone wild. They may be a metaphor for people losing it. Because everybody lost something when 2% of the population disappeared. And so perhaps the dogs represent, you know, humanity gone. And maybe the dog represents sanity coming back. I don't know. You know, I think it's up to interpretation what the dog means.
Well, I think some people have suggested, and I, when I say some people, I mean I. I've suggested that the GR were representative. I'm sorry, the dogs were representative of the GR. And now that they have fulfilled their mission on Memorial Day, they've made everybody remember. It's almost like their purpose has kind of reached an end. That they've had this I don't want to say catharsis, but is that something that could be a valid point as well? Like now that
I don't know. I mean,
zenith, the dogs are normal again, no longer feral.
Well, I don't think they're normal. You know, I mean, I think the GR still exists. Mm-hmm. This was a probably a GR all around the United States. You know, Memorial Day extravaganza, so to speak. You know, and I don't think they're over yet. You know what I mean? I don't think. I mean, I think that Lori certainly is disillusioned. You know, by that, but I don't know if the dogs represent the GR. I think it's really an interpretation that a lot of people have different interpretations of. I do.
Speaking of Lori, what impact do you think Tom's arrival back in Mapleton has on her?
Well, we'll see, won't we? I have no idea. But, you know, I do know that they are very connected. And I do know that she told him in episode 9, you know, it's not good to bury things. And I think when he sees her and she sees him, there's also perhaps some life that comes back into her eyes. I mean, you look at these two characters, both of them went off into cults, right? Mm-hmm. Both of them became disillusioned by the cults they were in. I mean, Lori's certainly disillusioned as she's walking on that jetty, looking into the water. What has my life become? What have I done? You know, her belief system, I think, shattered. It's just my interpretation. And I think he finds her there because it's their place. You know, they used to meet there and talk, and by chance he went there and he found her. You know, that's what I think anyway. I don't know.
Okay, so the last few questions that we have, first, they're actually kind of, they're one and the same. We interviewed Kath Lingenfelter earlier in the season, who I'm sure you obviously know. She is a superb, fantastic, utterly awesome writer of the show.
Yes, she is.
And she suggested in her interview that The Leftovers was, oddly enough, about hope. So would you agree with that statement? And did you feel like you conveyed that in the finale? And more specifically, like, you know, Kevin getting something of his family back. Also, seeing Nora, is she able to let go of her pain that she thought she got rid of when she hugged Wayne? Did you convey the hope that you think was possible out of this show?
I think I did. I mean, I think, you know, the show is about many things. I think the show is, as I said earlier, about grief and uncertainty and family and rebirth and spirituality and humanity at a loss, and, you know, people in, you know, in a spiritual predicament, and, you know, good versus evil. And I think the show ultimately is about hope, and I think we left it in a place of the possibility of life continuing. And I think it is about hope. Amongst all those other things, I do believe that. And I you know, when Nora, you know, picks up the baby and says, "Look what I found," you can see the hope in her eyes. You can see what this child is making her feel. And, you know, it's just really interesting that the son left this baby on the doorstep of his father, who is his stepfather, who took care of him. And Tom knew that he would take care of him, because Tom was abandoned and Kevin saved him. You know, Kevin took care of him. So, you know, nobody knows any of that stuff, right? I mean, we know that Tom left the baby. Nora doesn't know that. Kevin doesn't know that. Jill doesn't know that. But the baby represents hope. you know, the babies represent life. You know, the life force continues in the face of this madness that they're living in. And, you know, in the face of loss, there's hope. Yeah. Yep.
And what a cute baby that was. Whoever the casting director for that baby. Man, I'm hopeful after seeing that cute little mug.
Unless the baby is the Antichrist, like it was suggested in episode, I think it was 3 or 4, BJ and the AC.
Yeah, right. I remember.
Well, Mimi, what do you want your viewers to feel after they watch your show?
I want them to go deep and feel everything and question, you know, their lives, question humanity, question the things they're feeling and doing. You know, I think, you know, Damon and Tom have mapped out an incredible palette, an incredible landscape of feelings for us to all, you know, indulge in. And I know I'm grateful for them. Anyway, I just want our viewers to really feel something, not walk around not understanding.
Is there any last thing that you would like to emphasize for our listeners who are going to totally freak out once they hear this episode, by the way? They're going to be so pleased.
Really?
Oh, my God. Oh, yes. You have no idea. I've worked this up.
Maybe I've said too much.
No. You, trust me. I want you to say more. If I could pay you money to say more, I would.
I will probably be fired for saying everything I've said. But anyway.
So is there anything else you would want to add for our listeners? Anything we've already covered or have not covered you want to emphasize?
Keep watching. Keep questioning. I love what the viewers, you know, bring to it. It's insane, the depth that the viewers, you know, how deep they go, and it makes it all worthwhile for me. Because I'm as addicted to this show, being a part of it, as if I were a viewer, you know? Because ultimately, I am an audience, you know? I'm just very blessed to be part of this show. I'm loving every minute of it. So keep coming back.
We will. You've done such a fabulous job. And Mimi, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us here on the Living Reminders podcast. Blake and I sincerely loved chatting with you, and I hope that you had fun as well.
I did. Thank you so much, guys. I'll be listening.
All right, Blake. How are you doing?
Oh, God, I loved every second of that interview.
I know. She's just so brilliant.
I loved hearing all like the behind-the-scenes stuff. And knowing that how they designed the riot scenes, and then even like having her talk about Gladys the way that she did, how that Gladys was like a beloved character, you know, on set.
Mm. She is. It's not even was. Gladys still is so beloved, and sure. It really is so much thanks to Mimi. Mimi did that for us.
Yes.
You know, she was pained to do the stoning, and it was hard for her to shoot that, and it came across that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I said it in the interview. We called her mom hair. Like, you know, of course we don't want anyone to die, but we didn't have this deep love for Gladys. Yep. You know, she was just one of the rather annoying, more of the annoying guilty remnants who were just always in your face, you know, rifling through your stuff. And then Mimi made her human.
Listening to her talk about Nora in that episode, in that scene where she discovers her family, and the choice that she made to take the sound out, like she had it both ways, and she felt that Carrie Coon's acting without the sound spoke for itself, and I thought that was great, and how she had to wrestle with everything that she had to do with the beginning of the episode, and then make that flow with the end of the episode. I mean. She's a genius, man.
She really is.
She is great. You know, you could say, like, I wish you could have, like, a director off between she and Michelle McLaren. You know, the one.
I don't even want it. I just need them to continue doing what they're doing.
Yeah, just keep coming back and keep directing episodes of The Leftovers.
Yes.
That would be great. I would love every second of it.
We hope that you loved every second of this special interview. And Blake and I are hoping to set up some more on the hiatus. So if any of you have any connections to anybody who worked on the show.
Yeah, we'll take it.
I mean, granted, we did just interview the director of the finale, so our standards don't need to be as high as that, because I don't really know how much higher you can get. Unless you have a contact with Tom Perrotta or Damon Lindelof, then you best be contacting us. But honestly, we want to talk to the people who helped create the show that we just obsessed about for 10 weeks.
The special effects people, makeup people, wardrobe people. I mean, the guys who found the brown underwear that Wayne was wearing. I think that'd be a great idea too.
Yeah.
But you know, honestly though, thank you guys for listening to this interview. We were so proud to put it out, and I know Mimi was exceptionally happy to do it for all of you guys. This was the whole point. We wanted to give you the insider information straight from
the director's mouth.
Straight from the director's
mouth.
There
you go.
Okay, thank you. Straight from her mouth. Everything that she actually chose to do, you guys were in on it, and I think that's really cool.
It's really cool for me.
I mean, like, I'm a nerd, and maybe that's why we're doing a podcast, because I'm a super geek.
I feel like almost everyone listening to this is a little nerdy, because we're this obsessed with The Leftovers that we want to listen to the director go bit by bit. Oh my goodness. Well, guys, here's the great thing. The season of The Leftovers is over, but The Living Reminders is not. We're not even close to being over. We still have to go through all of the listener feedback that you sent in about the finale.
And if you have any feedback about this interview too, call us. Let us know what the feedback is. Granted, you don't have a lot of time. I think you got, once this episode is published, you have about 24 hours.
Just send it in.
Send it in. Doesn't matter. Voicemails, emails. It's going to be a big episode.
And speaking of big episodes, don't forget the MegaCast is coming up. We want you to send in your questions in regards to the MegaCast, which we will be doing with the Guilty Remnant podcast. So if you have any questions specific to us four hosts, maybe you want to have us do a duel about sudden theories or something like that. Whatever it is, or if you just want to put in your two cents, please contact us and make sure that you tell us that it's in regards to the MegaCast.
And even if it's just like personal stuff, like, hey, what's your favorite food? Or you want to get to know more about Mary and I, or Dylan and Tiffany. We're more than happy to take those questions too. I think it'd be fun. This is just.
Oh my God! I hope someone asks me what my favorite food is.
I know. Don't say it. Don't say it.
I won't. I won't.
it's.
Oh, I'm drooling thinking about it.
Oh my God! The Leftovers MegaCast is a fan appreciation podcast for you guys. You guys have put up with us from the very beginning.
You've been our friends. You've literally listened to now what, 11 hours of us?
I know. Actually more than that. Geez, way more than that.
Oh my gosh. Well, nonetheless,
I'd say at least 15 hours.
You've gotten to know us and let us know what you want to know.
I've literally talked to you people more in 15 hours than I have my entire family, I'd say, in about 3 years. Yep. So,
cheers to that.
I know, right? We spend a lot of time with you guys, and not only just recording, but Twitter and Facebook and emails and the voicemails. I look forward to speaking to you guys.
You guys are our friends.
You really are. And it's like kind of lame.
In like a really creepy, not creepy way.
Yeah.
Mind you, Blake and I met at Match.com. So we believe in internet relationships. We do. We're not ashamed to hide it.
That's true. We did meet on Match.com 7 long years ago.
And Match.com said that we could not be in a commercial for them, because if they did that to every success story, they'd be bankrupt.
And that we're not lying about that. We actually contacted them so they would pay for our wedding.
And they said no.
They were like, nah, bro, we can't do that. Sorry.
Oops. Anyway, thank you all so incredibly much for listening to this episode. Get in all that feedback. Don't forget, you can find us on thelivingreminders.com. You can tweet us and Instagram us and even Facebook us. All three, the handles
and everything.
It's just Living Reminders. Send us an email, thelivingreminders@gmail.com.
No, let me say it how I say it.
Oh, sorry.
livingreminders@gmail.com.
Like, you think that you're like paid by Google or something.
No, I have a fantastic radio voice, and I think I should be able to say gmail.com upon any time I feel like I wish.
Okay.
I like how we're right now. gmail.com.
Anyway.
Want me to do it again?
Gmail.com. We have two other podcasts, guys, so Blake like gets to say gmail.com multiple times a week. I wish we had a better hobby. This is why I'm trying to sign you up for art classes. You need to find something more exciting than saying gmail.com.
Gmail.com.
Good Lord.
You want me to say the number too?
503-454-6730.
I'm surprised you can memorize that.
Listen, I can memorize pretty much anything.
Yeah, except, you know, the important things in life.
Like what?
Like telling your wife thank you for dinner.
I did say thank you for dinner.
No, you didn't.
Mary made me dinner this evening. I did say thank you.
No, you know what you did? You looked at the baby and you said, Mama made me dinner.
And I said thank you.
You didn't.
Yes, I did.
Ladies and gents, if you think a wife would remember if she was thanked or not, you can send us that tweet. Blake does not remember everything.
You can send it to us at livingreminders@gmail.com.
All right, everyone. We're done with this. Poor Mimi just listened to you and I banter.
I know. Sorry, Mimi.
But everyone, keep on loving The Leftovers. And in my opinion, hey, in this hiatus, rewatch it. Rewatch it and love those characters and that show even more.
Because you missed out on stuff. I'm sure that we missed out on stuff too. And hey, hell, we do a podcast about it. So, well, I'm totally going to rewatch and I'll cry again at the finale, just like I did the first two times.
Thanks so much for tuning in.
Thanks, guys.
I'm Mary.
My name is Blake.
And this is The Living Reminders.
Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.